handle the truth.
Should we or should we not follow the advice of the galactically stupid?
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe fuck yourself.
You're all a bunch of fucking assholes. You know why? You don't have the guts to be what you want to be. You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fucking fingers and say, that's the bad guy.
Clearly, don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Righteous Prick Podcast. I'm your host, J.L. Covan. It is 8:53 in the morning on November 16th in the year of our Lord, 2020. We're doing the post-blueberry eggs black coffee breakfast recording because I don't have an assignment from work yet. So I figured, you know what, I think last week's episode was righteous and good. And maybe it was that big, healthy breakfast energy that I was bringing to the table. So we're doing a morning episode. Cookie has already retreated to one of the bedrooms because she's cut out the middleman now, and I respect that. You know, usually when I start talking into a microphone by myself, she clickety-clacks over to me and checks me out and then leaves the room. This time she just left the room, so she's learning. You can teach an old dog new tricks, and she resents being called an old dog since she's only like 5 and a half. And she's not afraid of burning in hell. I figured I'd get my Ron Reagan Jr. out there quick to start the podcast. We're going to be all over the place, but I swear we have some important things to talk about. I think we're only a month away from Grammy nominations being announced, guys. And fingers crossed for Fireside Crap's The Deuce getting nominated. Now, in the plus column, I went viral this year. I had exponential growth in terms of my subscribers and followers across all platforms that I'm on, not on Facebook. And the album debuted at number 34 on iTunes. Not iTunes comedy, folks. All of iTunes. It debuted at number 34 on the charts, which has to be pretty good. I didn't see another comedy album crack the top 100 for another 2 months, and I haven't checked since. So I was right behind the Frozen 2 soundtrack when I debuted. So that was pretty good. It sat at number one for a while on iTunes. It was number one on Amazon for like 2 weeks straight. So I'm pretty sure it was the best-selling streaming comedy album of May 2020. And obviously you combine that with my viral status, especially during that time, before I was shadow banned by Twitter as a political account. And you'd think that would bode well in a year where there's been less comedy content, less high profile comedy content. You would hope that would bode well. Now, my prediction is that probably the five albums that get nominated will be four or five will be produced by Comedy Dynamics, the monster behemoth that is working hand in glove with Netflix to flood the market with comedy specials. And I believe I've told the story a few times about how Comedy Dynamics wanted to. I was managed by New Wave, which was the outfit for about 4 months before they fired my manager and then lost interest in me because it was my manager and not the company that was truly interested in building my career. But and this was in 2007, just to give you perspective. But around 2010, I was at the Boston Comedy Festival, and I got a call from LA, and this still happens to me to this day. Anytime you get a call from like 818, you're like, oh my God, is this my big break? Is this a TV station who wants to fucking put me on TV and make me a star finally? And it was somebody from New Wave Dynamics, which New Wave was a management outfit, and then they turned into New Wave Dynamics, where they were going to get involved in streaming, not streaming, but content production. They were going to become a content production, and they were looking to build their catalog of albums. And they asked me, and they were like, so we have this incredible distribution network, and it's going to be great for your publicity, and like, you, we only want 50, we want 50%, but you're going to grow so much in terms of the exposure we get you that it's going to be worth it. And I said, let me think about it. And then I called them back a day later. I was like, no. And it was the best decision I ever made in my career, because I realized what they were doing in hindsight. They knew. And they, so they went from New Wave Dynamics to become Comedy Dynamics, which is, you know, the fucking, the Disney Plus. They're the Disney, they're the Disney of comedy content creation. You know, it feels like three out of every four specials you'll see on a platform will be produced by Comedy Dynamics. And I just thought to myself, I was like, wait a second, you guys didn't want to rep me when you had me after a flame emoji late night performance, because, you know, there was just the one guy there that believed in me, and the rest of you could give a shit. And when he was fired, I was sort of, I became dead weight. And this was when I was just at the peak of my physical condition. I looked like a fucking model. I was fucking, my career was on the upswing, but for whatever reason, you know, the Hillary Clinton, J.L. Covan curse of like, there's just something about you just hit my career at that pivotal point. But I said, okay, so 3 years later or 2 years later, you're contacting me to do what now? To give you half the rights to my albums, which admittedly are not selling well, but I own every bit of them. And I thought, no, there's something fishy here. There's just something fishy. I don't know what it is, but it just feels off. So I trusted my instinct, and my instincts were correct, because as I've told you on this podcast before, sorry if this is redundant, but maybe there's a few new listeners out there. I trusted myself, and from the years 2015 to 2019, the single biggest payday in my comedy career, the majority, not like the biggest single, I'm talking the over, about 75% of the money I made as a comedian between 2015 and 2019 was from satellite radio, Sirius XM, from Pandora, for my albums, because I was both the artist, I had the artist rights, and the owner rights to all my stuff. And until this year, that was what basically helped keep me financially interested in comedy, because I said, hey, if I put out an album, boom, I can make another $20,000 this year from streaming, because I do pretty well on those platforms. So by owning my stuff, I ended up saving my own career probably. Because if you're making $0 every year, if you're making $5,000 doing 14 road gigs, what are you sticking around for? I mean, it's a hobby, but it's a very time-consuming hobby where you're giving up weekends or nights to pursue it. So like at some point, that's gonna erode your desire to do it. So by having that money, and I thought to myself, Comedy Dynamics, New Wave Dynamics at the time, who would become Comedy Dynamics, my thinking is that they knew all along where the business was headed. That makes them good businessmen, shrewd, but it also makes them sleazy, because they just grew and grew into a behemoth. And I think what they wanted from my albums was nothing to do with me. I think they wanted to amass the largest collection so that they could then publicize that both to talent and media, as we are the largest library of comedy content, which will then entice other people to join, which will give them leverage and stature in the industry as a content creator. Now, that worked. And I guarantee you, if I had given them Racial Chameleon and Diamond Maker in 2010, I would have seen no more money. They would have obviously tried to foster a relationship with me. But the thing is, and I've said this to comedians repeatedly, I can't believe how many comedians do deals with. Now, that said, I, for 17 years, I have had pretty much an unflinching belief in my comedy talent. I have had almost no faith in the comedy business, but I have basically believed in my talent the whole time. That's why I'm still doing it. There were three factors that kept me in comedy: my belief in my own talent, streaming money, which we just went over, and two radio podcast people in particular, Rod, as a, who I've mentioned repeatedly, Rod and Karen of The Black Guy Who Tips, they expanded my audience. I forget even when we started, maybe it was, it's already like 5 years or something since I've been sort of building a relationship with them. And their podcast is blowing up. But they, when I was struggling to get gigs, which is obviously a good way, if you're not going viral for stuff, that's a good way to build fans. And it was just not, I wasn't building a huge fan base. You know, maybe I go on a road gig and pick up 10 or 11 fans. And that's nice. But then, you know, I remember going to Toledo, Ohio in 2011. And I remember I had like 10 fans from there. And I specifically remember the day, like a few of them like stopped following me in like 2015. And in my head, I was like, well, I haven't been to your club in 4 years. I haven't been on TV. I don't even blame you for stopping following me. You're like, I guess you gave it a shot. And then you're like, I guess he's not going to make it. Or I guess, you know, like I don't need to follow this comedian who's always promoting when I never see him and don't know what he's doing. Whatever the case may be. But Rod and Karen of the Black Eye Tips gave me a platform and a fan base. And then Pete Dominic, to a lesser degree, but still significant, from his show on Sirius and now his successful podcast. So those are the three factors. A few nice people who opened their fan base to me. The streaming money I got, the royalty money I got from Sound Exchange for satellite radio playing my albums. And I now have 6 albums all self-produced. So that's, I've made, you know, over the course of the last 6 years, probably in the last 6 years, have I made gross, not net, when you take out taxes. But I've definitely made, even when you take out taxes, over 6 figures in the last 5 years from streaming. So that's real money. That's real money when your work history is intermittent because you're keeping yourself flexible for comedy gigs. That's real money. There were months where you're sitting there not knowing what you got on Sound Exchange, and then all of a sudden you get like that, oh shit, $2,100 this month after taxes. Fuck yes. Like, there you go, bills. So what Comedy Dynamics, I think, did in their origins was like, and they still do it to this day, and there's other record companies that do it. I do not understand. Comics talk that big shit of like, you can do it yourself. But then that ego, they can't wait to partner up because they're going to get featured on iTunes, or they're going to get a nice recording that's paid for. Like, you know, you don't have to put any upfront money. I've paid for every recording I've done, and not cheap, not fucking cheap. But I just said, I will make this money back. I think this album is going to be great. Most of them have been. And it's paid off. It hasn't made me a star. But, you know, what I keep hoping is, you know what, if this year I can get a special, if I can get, you know what, if I can reach 1 million people or millions of people somehow with a comedy special, man, if even 10,000 out of 1 million people go buy multiple albums, or 20,000 people or 100,000 stream some albums, that could be real big money that comes all to me. I don't split it with anybody or anything. And the fact that Comedy Dynamics wanted to, for not even to produce the album, but to put it in their catalog, their holy catalog, which I think was total bullshit. I mean, it would have been there, but they were just looking to amass as many people, spin their bullshit so that they could have this large catalog, which, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Once you can get a bunch of people's work, you can then start to spin yourself as, hey, guys, you should work with us because we have the largest catalog. We've worked with so many people. So it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy, almost like, and I think they had to know the future of streaming and royalties. I have to believe they knew that, because if that became reality in like 2013, 2014 for everybody, wouldn't a big company steeped in the business know that in 2011? Like, wouldn't they know where the winds were blowing? So I'm happy that I never signed anything to them. And I don't even know where this was going, but I don't understand why comics don't self-produce more. They all love talking that shit like they're fucking pioneers going west, young man. But as soon as that, like, oh, I'll be featured on, all I have to do is sign over half my royalties in perpetuity, sure, because I'll have a little ego boost right away. I don't know why they do it. It's, you know, I genuinely don't. Invest in yourself. You could be like me and fail, but it's still, even as a no-name part-time comedian, part-time lawyer for financial reasons, it's still been a great decision to sell. Even even though that moment hasn't come yet where I sell, 3,000 records a week for a few weeks, or that people are buying up my catalog, or if I got a Netflix special, you'd see four of my albums shoot to the top just because hundreds of people were like streaming and buying them. Even without that moment, it's been the most lucrative part of my career until 2020. So I don't know how many comics listen to this, but and I will say this, not everybody's me. And I say that as arrogant as that sounds. I'm an elite comedian. Don't give a fuck what my status is. I know I'm an elite comedian. I mean, the proof is sort of out there now, but for real, I am. And if you're an actor, or an actress, or a media personality, or somebody famous, or just an influencer who happens to listen to this podcast, please stop tagging me with shitty non-comedians who have done one thing. God. It was like, first it was lip sync, and it was like, get the fuck out of here. This person is a whack comedian. What has the world gone fucking mad? I don't want MSNBC picking the next comedy stars. I'm more comfortable with MSNBC picking the next president and endorsing the next president, but I don't need them picking comedy stars. But then these other people, and I wrote down as a title for this episode, because I've talked about it already, but cover band comedy is what I wrote. And I have no idea if I talked about this last week, but I've been bitching about it to the Righteous Girlfriend for weeks, and she's certainly tired of it. There is so much fraud in fucking comedy now, and if I am so tired of comedy not being treated like another art. I know it's a little easier, the barrier to entry. You don't have to be a good singer to join. You can be a shitty comedian and just be a comedian. There's no barrier to entry. But we are at a stage in comedy where, like, if somebody gets up at your local bar and starts singing karaoke and they're not that good, people just go, "Wow, you're a singer. You should quit. You're a singer. I love your singing." Or you're just, even if it's bad, it's like, "I consider you a singer." That's where we're at with comedy content now. And as I've said before, comedy is currency on social media. You know, if you can't do backflips, if you don't have Triple H tits, if you're not famous, or you're not insanely talented at something else, that like music or something, comedy's the thing where you can just sort of like try a funny thing or copy a funny person, and you get to like get some of that currency. It's the cheapest available currency, and in some ways it's the most lucrative. The bang for your buck for doing funny things on the internet is higher than anything else. Like, if you're a trained singer or can do backflips or can bench press 600 pounds, you've had to work hard to get there, whether it's steroids or natural or you know with lifting. You've had to put in a ton of work just to get like that viral video of like, "Look at this guy doing like a jump squat with 315 on his back. That's insane." He didn't just wake up one morning and decide he was going to do an incredibly difficult feat. A singer doesn't wake up and go, "I think I'm going to be a great singer today and see if social media likes it." But with comedy, you're just like, "I'm going to try and do something funny." And then that, you know, so it's low risk. It's the return on investment is highest in comedy because it requires almost no investment. Now, it requires some investment if you're great at comedy, but you know, a lot of people get lucky these days. But I am seeing so much fucking copying, and I know I've bitched about this, but it's, as a comedian, it really fucking bothers me. I have seen outright theft, and people will then tag the thief and the original and be like, "You guys have made quarantine so much better." And it's like, this motherfucker is stealing. And it's an extension. I was thinking about this. I was trying to draw, like, I was going to write a blog about this, but nobody reads. But Chris Stapleton, okay? Here's just an example. Chris Stapleton, big country singer. I have two of his albums. I saw him on Saturday Night Live. I've seen a couple of artists on Saturday Night Live in the last few years. And I remember one of them was Greta Van Fleet. And they sounded like a ripoff of Led Zeppelin, and yet I still liked how it sounded. And he could still sing. He wasn't lip-syncing Led Zeppelin. I bought an album of theirs, enjoyed it. They have this song, Safari Song, which I think fucking rocks for real. Like, it sounds like a Led Zeppelin. What it sounds like is a Led Zeppelin cover band who decided to do their own original material. And goddamn, Safari Song fucking rocks. And I was like, oh shit, good. Thanks, SNL. And I've heard a couple of, be honest, I don't own any Justin Bieber songs. Maybe I do. Maybe I own one. Don't tell anybody. But I've actually enjoyed some of Justin Bieber's performances. I even bought a Migos song, I think, after they were on SNL, but not based on the SNL performance. I was actually like, this sucks. But then I listened to like the studio version. I was like, this isn't bad. But Chris Stapleton, his performance kicked fucking ass. And I was like, God damn. This was awesome. So I bought two of his albums, and like he had come out with a kind of a Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 sort of double album. And I'm listening to his music, and this is a big time Grammy nominated or winning superstar at this point. And some real good bluesy rock shit, like a couple songs that I think are just fucking great. And then this song came on and I was like, oh, did he do a cover of Etta James, I'd Rather Go Blind? Well, no, he didn't. And I can't remember the name of his song, but I was listening. I was like, wait a second. Does anybody care about this anymore? This shit is straight ripping off Etta James. And that's a famous fucking song. I'd Rather Go Blind is pretty goddamn famous. Like, I'm not one of these. I know movies and I know comedy. I don't know fucking music like that. Like, I'm not one of those people, you know, I'm not like, oh, actually that's a, it's famous. I'd Rather Go Blind is famous. And I was like, wait, is he not crediting this? And this was around the same time, like Sam Smith had to pay Tom Petty, who I believe was living at the time, for what's his big song? That slow song that made Sam Smith a star. But anyway, they were saying it like copied I Won't Back Down. And I was like, it is? I can't even hear. I don't know music that well, but I don't hear it. But he paid. He paid like a settlement or something to like make it go away, or to like as a sort of peace offering. And then we know what happened to Robin Thicke. Still, by the way, my reigning song of the summer, despite Demi Lovato's valiant efforts with Cool for the Summer in 2015. Peak Demi Lovato, by the way. Call me if you're out there. Let's collab. big fan of Demi Lovato. But let's to be fair, and I don't mind that she's... let me just put 2015 Demi Lovato. I've often said there's different levels. There's cheat on your girlfriend, there's leave your girlfriend, and then there's where do you want to bury my girlfriend's body level attractive and interested. 2015 Demi Lovato was definitely let's get the shovels and find a safe place. Just kidding, righteous girlfriend who only listens to this podcast once every like 7 weeks. but Cool for the Summer was a pretty good jam. But for me, Hot in Here was my song of the summer for about 12 years until Blurred Lines came out. And then it was the reigning champ for 7 years, undisputed. Just, I mean, Cool for the Summer gave it a run, but that wasn't based solely on music. That was based on fit Demi Lovato, just looking like a nastier Demi Moore. And she's got the pipes. But Blurred Lines' reign finally came to a close in 2020 because the Sky Rizzy song, Things Are Getting Clearer. Nothing is everything. That's my new summer jam, because that's all I heard this year being inside, and I do enjoy. I actually, confession, tried to Shazam the Sky Rizzy song when I first heard it, because I was like, oh, this can't just be a pharmaceutical ad song. This has to be a real pop song that they're sampling. Nope. That was an original. That was a Sky Rizzy original song. And then I listened to the lyrics and I was like, yeah, they're talking about clear skin. This is clearly a pharmaceutical ad job. Nobody's dropping hits on the top one on the Billboard top 40 about clearing up your skin. Unless it's done in like an ironic Blink 182 way. Your skin's fucked up, but I still like you. Let's go out. That was an original Blink 182 song I just did for you guys. And we'll get to some new limited impressions for you. Chris Stapleton, I was just like, and then I Googled it. I was like, oh, yeah, people were like, yeah, this is like fucking Etta James. I was like, okay, I'm not alone in this. I didn't think I would be. Then he had another song. And I just listened to, at the time I heard it, I just listened to Malcolm Gladwell. Malcolm Gladwell's podcast. And he had talked about a couple of country songs. This Vince Gill song, Go Tell High on the Mountain or something. Like a really nice song by Vince Gill. And this famous George Jones song, He Stopped Loving Her Today. It's a very famous country song that I didn't know until Malcolm Gladwell played it. And the cool thing about that Gladwell podcast, it was like season two or some shit of his Revisionist History podcast, available on Dabidabe. And what's his platform? Revisionist podcast on, it's some fucking pretentious sounding shit on Polar Studios podcasting. J.L. Covan, 6'7", a little overweight, very angry, sort of like a biracial lumberjack. There you go. There's some limited Malcolm Gladwell. And by the way, if I can't go get a haircut for the next 5 months, I might actually finally be able to do my Malcolm Gladwell impression with half fro. Because my barber, every time I walk by my barber in Jersey, who is not my real barber, he's my COVID barber. As soon as I can go back safely into the city, like for, you know, haircut level safety, I'm going back to my Egyptian barber who understands my hair. This dude's terrible. That's why I just go with the buzz cut. I'm like, you can't fuck up a buzz cut. And to be fair, he kind of fucked up the first two buzz cuts. But every time I walk by the barbershop, him and his partner in crime, no masks, motherfuckers in the shop, no masks. And I'm like, oh, fuck this. And yeah, it's just not, it's not a safe environment. And now that there's an explosion in Essex County, across the country, but Essex County in New Jersey is a verifiable hot spot. Time to not go back there anymore. Well, that was a tangent that I just forgot. So I was talking about songs. Oh, Chris Stapleton. So George Jones. He stopped loving her today. And you're like, oh, my God, it's a breakup song? Well, spoiler, the end of the song is she died and he made a promise to love her till death do us part. So it's this like little reveal. It's a little M. Night Shyamalan trailer park country song. Where it's like at the end, you're like, oh, she's been dead the whole time. He didn't stop loving her because they fell out of love. He stopped loving her because she's no longer with us. And obviously, yes, somebody out there is going, you can still love people that you lose, of course, but you get the point, right? And I'm sitting to this Chris Stapleton song, and the Chris Stapleton song is like, he stopped praying today. And I'm like, oh, is this about a dude becoming a woke atheist? No, he stopped praying because he died and he wasn't afraid of burning in hell. And I'm going, you just ripped off a fucking famous country song, country superstar. If I know that shit from listening to Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History, available Panoply. That's it, Panoply. Panoply Podcast with Malcolm Gladwell. And, you know, if I know that, so I'm sitting there going, Chris Stapleton, et tu, staple A? And, yeah, I couldn't, like, I was just like, you got some great original shit, but, like, really? He stopped praying today, or he stopped going to church today. And I'm like, isn't that just a copy, like a very loose remix of the fucking famous song by George Jones? Anyway, I got back into it because, quick sidebar. Ken Burns' Mount Rushmore of documentaries, okay? The Mount Rushmore of Ken Burns' work. Number one, Civil War. Still the most, still a top five thing I've ever seen. In TV, movies, documentaries, visual, like top five thing I've ever seen, the Civil War. Baseball, which is a worthy heir apparent. Baseball, I was blown away by how great it was. I didn't expect it to be so close in quality to the Civil War because the Civil War was so amazing what he did with that. Number three, Vietnam War. My favorite of his sort of modern ones where there's like more video work and stuff. He wasn't as reliant on just narration and photo skills. And country music, which went up, was that late last year or was that early this year? Country music, fascinating. Awesome. And Malcolm Gladwell's whole point with going through country music was the similarities between country music and rap in terms of telling a unique story, often of the downtrodden, and the power of the narrative. Now rap has no fucking narrative. But, you know, you go 80s and 90s rap, there were a lot of stories, a lot of biography, you know, as I forget who it was, maybe an NWA who was saying, it might have been Ice Cube who was saying it was like they're reporting from the streets. That's what hip hop was in the beginning. Now it's just, let's make a 2-minute nonsensical song to go viral because we'll get lots of hits on SoundCloud. So when I heard Chris Stapleton doing Fraud, I felt it was musical fraud. We're doing strong musical fraud. I thought, well, is the culture really becoming more exciting? Now, Robin Thicke had to pay off a shit ton of money because people are like, you don't fuck with Marvin Gaye. But I still love Blurred Lines. I still love both songs. But, man, do I love Blurred Lines. And that brings me, of course, to my usual gripe about TikTok, which is just the culture is becoming, and by the way, thoughts and prayers, the Milli Vanilli track. There are Keep My Enemies Closer and Thoughts and Prayers are, I feel like those are my two children that I want to become successful for because I want them to be revisited by tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. I want those two albums to be heard by any serious comedy fan in the fucking world. Because I'm that proud of it. But that Milli Vanilli track, I had no fucking idea how great. That was a great track when I recorded it. And it is now, I think, by force of history and entertainment, that I might have to consider that my greatest track ever, even though Why White Women Disappear, the closing masterpiece on Keep My Enemies Closer, is probably my personal favorite of all time. I think history will judge Milli Vanilli, the Kim Kardashian versus Milli Vanilli, as my greatest work because of how prescient it was. But TikTok is changing the comedy culture for the worse. And because comedy is already the least respected, it needed to be protected the most. We still get outraged at other things being stolen. And even in stand-up comedy, among stand-up comedians, if you steal... you can be ostracized. Carlos Mencia will never escape. No matter how many people go to his shows, he will never escape that label of being a fucking, you know, comedy thief. And that's the way it should be because comedy is such a demeaned art form that requires its ranks to protect it with the honor code. Just the way like putting Donald Trump in the White House with no guardrails, he will just abuse the system he will even break the law if he thinks he can get away with, but he will certainly violate norms. Comedy is like that. It's like a norms based honor system in terms of you don't steal and we will fucking out you and get in your face if you steal because we understand that it's kind of an honor system. But TikTok and social media have brought more and more fucking thieves. And because it's not as respected an art form, fewer and fewer people call it out. There's a comedian, a real comedian, a stand-up comedian who got very famous on Twitter. And I see people like ripping it off. Ripping his fucking shtick off and ripping another woman's act off. And nobody fucking says anything. They just, they like lump them together and go, oh my God, you're all so great. And I'm sitting there going, it ain't my fight, but I want to make it my fight because I fucking care about respect for originality in comedy. But when you see the tide turning, it starts with Chris Stapleton, but it turns into lip syncing becoming just as accepted and just as respected a form of comedy genius. Well, what happened when the lip sync queen got to do some real comedy? A fucking cultural disaster. An artistic abortion is what fucking happened, okay? And it surprised nobody that actually gives a shit or pays attention to real comedy, but artistic abortion, possible comedy title for the episode. But as you see more and more people just copying and going, we should do this. I'm going to do, oh, you went far. And I know I've complained about this, but it's somebody has to say it. Somebody with a bigger platform than me. Unfortunately, majority of my fans only care if I fucking dump on Trump on social media. But to my real fans, people who listen to this shit, like this is the message that has to get out. And it's not. And I feel like it's a slippery slope that we're sliding down into sort of comedy. It's this perfect storm of, well, comedy is the easiest entry and the least respected, and especially stand-up comedy. And so it's this easy entry and low criticism and high reward. You don't have to be a fucking singer or an acrobat or a technical wizard to make fun comedy content in 2 minute bites. And nobody's standing up for it. So people are flooding it, and people without the ethics of stand-up comedians. And stand-up comedy is full of shitty people. But at least on an artistic level, there's a real respect for the art and for people who steal to get ostracized and shit on. So I can't vouch for the personal conduct of every comedian, but I can tell you for sure, there are a lot of awful people in stand-up comedy. But as artists, there is bad, good, and great all sort of adhere mostly to the you don't steal. You suck on your own, you succeed on your own. But there's a lot of people entering the fray who are just like, oh, I did my own version of there. And I'm like, there's no fucking thing. There's no such thing as cover band comedy, you fucking cunt. You can't do it. Because all you're doing is taking from the original. You're not covering it. In music, if you're a cover band, A, people know what you're doing. You don't cover unknown people's shit. You cover famous stuff, so they already know what you're doing, and you still got to sing and play the songs. In comedy, if you steal from somebody with 40,000 followers and you get yourself 40,000 followers who never the two shall meet, you're just stealing an act. You're just stealing material. You're not covering it. You're not doing your spin on it. You're just stealing an act. And it's a fucking disgrace what's happening, and I feel like the culture around comedy in general is becoming less... You know, you get saturated from Comedy Dynamics and Netflix. You say, and by the way, Netflix, please give me a special. But you get saturated with more and more specials so they don't seem as special. That's kind of a first step. Then you have apps like TikTok that popularize copying and not creating original things. And then you get to social media where some people say, oh, either they knowingly steal or they don't understand that cover band comedy isn't a fucking thing. And they dilute the and soon you're in a fucking free for all where people don't respect, honor, and appreciate real originality, real quality comedy. And it's a fucking disgrace because, like I've said before, I have to be the fucking Lorax warning people. Except I have skin in the game now as somebody who's gone viral and has a big following, so people will think I'm a hater because they don't understand what integrity is. Just like when people don't understand why I'm not on Facebook anymore. I'm like, I don't know. I think the destruction of democracy and the promotion of white supremacy and hate groups and a hateful, lying president is not worth my comedy career. So if I can, it turned out for the best because Twitter ended up being where I blew up. But of course, would I have a lot more followers if I had stayed on Facebook? Yes, I would have another platform, especially a platform that not everybody has both pages. A lot of people prefer Facebook. But I chose not to be on there. And when people get surprised, they're like, wow, that's a big move for a comedian. I go, it might be a big move for a comedian because you think comedians have no fucking ethics. But it's not a big move for a human being to quit a shitty website that is damaging democracy, that is fucking the midwife to Trump fucking this country over. And obviously I think I've voiced my complaints about the Howard Stern show. I see a guy... This is also personal. There's another impersonator out there. And if you fucking tag me I don't even want to tell people. I don't even want to tell my fans. Don't tag me in this person's material because I want my fans to know. I don't want to have to educate my own fans on what's good and what's shit. But the only Trump impersonator I respect that's still doing it or that got famous doing it, and I think mine is better than his. I have no problem saying that, but I also have no problem with people preferring his or respecting him, is that guy Anthony Adamanuick. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but you know who he is. He's the guy from The President Show. And the thing I respect about it is he did a solid impression, but he worked hard at it. He created content, and almost most importantly to me, he didn't shy away from the politics of it. He was a clear Trump hater with his comedy, and I felt like that's the only way to do it right. You can't do that, both sides, and I'm just trying to have fun, because then you're weak. You're a pandering bitch if you do that. So his impression, I never mind when people compare me and his. I think he is a respectable impersonator, and I'm fine with that. I think mine is better, but that's okay. He might think his is better, and that's okay. It's wrong, but that's okay. but... That should let you know, anybody else you want to tag me in as a good Trump impersonator, I mean anybody, no thanks, pass. And one guy I've seen who wanted to collaborate. He was sort of famous, done late night shows, having some success. He's not a comedian. I think he's just an actor. He was having some success before I emerged, and he sought out to collaborate with me right after I went viral, you know, just a fucking piggyback. And I said, no. I said, I come from the fucking, you know, I'm a Rafa Nadal, Novak Djokovic comedian. I do it myself. I'm a solo player. I do it myself. You go do your things and may the best impersonator win. But what I've noticed looking at this guy's material, and somebody tagged me in it. And by the way, I just edited out something there because I didn't want to name names. But a very famous person had retweeted one of these people's pieces of content, even though this famous person had also been made aware of mine. And mine, let me just put it to you this way. My Trump content that was on the similar subject as this other person's, it's like an A plus to a fucking C minus, okay? Not close. And I got very angry seeing it retweeted because I watched it and I noticed that this guy, since I blew up, has basically been taking notes off of fucking me, okay? He's been fucking taking notes. He has adjusted the way he's done certain things. And I notice he's doing little ticks that I've been doing for months in my shit. Now, he doesn't do them as well, but when you see somebody getting a big platform and getting shared as some, it enrages me. Because people should know better. Artists and fame, you wish artists actually gave a shit and had appreciation for other people's. I don't give a fuck if you're a fucking A-list actor with William fucking Morris up your ass. You don't show respect to comedy, you're fucking worthless to me. Okay? If I can tell when somebody fucking rips off your movie or your song, show some fucking respect and know when somebody is clearly a fucking weak, watered down version of a real original. But no, when you're not a stand-up comedian, you think the world is your fucking thing to pick and choose and borrow and do all this shit. And I am, once again, the way I had to restrain myself during the rise of fucking lip sync nothing, I have to restrain myself now. Once again, I have to be quiet in the hopes that I don't ruin future money, even though there is no industry money coming my way right now. All the money I've made this year, and I made a lot, has been all on me as an individual, people reaching out to me as an individual to do work, to do messages, my YouTube channel doing well. But I don't care who the fuck you are. I hate seeing people knowingly share garbage content when they should know that somebody's a fucking thief or at least a fucking pale imitation of. And this also brings me to Howard Stern. Yeah, we're doing this episode, folks. And I've got, trust me, stick around. I've got some limited impressions that I want to share with you from some movies I watched. And I've got a big 2021 plan for myself. I have three things written down, and I know I've shared this in previous, but I've really mapped out my year now. And I may have to do these things all self-produced. I may have to throw some of my 2020 money into myself and maybe not make it back. A sketch pilot. I am going to film a pilot for my sketch series. Will it get picked up? I don't know, but hopefully it gets a million hits on YouTube. I've got it mapped out, and I can only say this to you guys. This looks wrong, but I genuinely think I could make the next fucking Chappelle show. Sorry, I know that's so crazy to think, but you know, it's maybe I'm, you know, in other words, maybe I'm not LeBron James, but you know what? I can fucking play like Jimmy Butler. I can have nights where I can fucking do my thing. And that's what I think. I'm trying to be the LeBron James of comedy, but if I'm not, people are going to still see that I'm first team all comedy or second team all comedy, even if I'm not the league MVP or the GOAT. And what I have mapped out for my sketch pilot, let's share it with you guys. I want to use one of my Ken Burns sketches, which I shared last week, because I just still think that those need a wider audience, and they're evergreen, that those two sketches. So I would use the anchor sketch would be the Ken Burns sketch. That would wrap up the half hour episode. I think I might not do intro. I don't know whether I would do intro or stand up clips, like whether I would instill a Seinfeldian stand up segment at the beginning of the show or to introduce each thing in an episode, or if I would do the Chappelle, hey guys, thanks for coming to the show, blah, blah, blah. The Candace Owens dating show, absolutely. The Trump Kings of Comedy sketch, which I already filmed, that might be the intro sketch. the Candace Owens dating show where she, it's called Tie the Knot. I think I described this on Rod's podcast, and I may have done it in a Trump video. Candace Owens dating cops who've murdered black men. It's like a Bachelor show, but or a Love Connection show, but she's choosing among cops who've killed black men. Tie the Knot, and the knot is a noose instead of like a wedding ring. I've just jotted down notes, and I'm writing a sketch that I want to get permission from Richard Marx, my cyber friend. But basically a sketch where it's like Richard Marx is singing like songs for charity, and he's got all these beautiful love songs, but then he gets interrupted various times by Twitter alerts. And if you've seen Richard Marx go off on people on Twitter, I thought it would be a funny thing of almost like a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde sketch where Richard Marx is like playing songs. And then and I shouldn't be telling any of this because I could have somebody, I've heard some of my shit get used on SNL. I'm not fucking kidding. So I, you know, both from this podcast and from the Making Podcast Great Again. But I got to share it with somebody. You know, I got the creative juices flowing and I don't have the patience to hold it in. These are the sketches I'm writing right now and we'll put in my pilot. And some of the sketches are already been done. Half the show has already been done on my YouTube channel and half I'm writing. But yeah, it's going to be, I'm going to film that. I'm going to film that. And it will cost me probably $2,000, but I'm going to film it because I want to make it and I'll put it on YouTube as the JL Covan Show or JL Comedy, the JL Comedy Sketch Show. And if it gets bought or interest, great. And if it doesn't, you'll have something to watch in hopefully spring of 2021 when we can film it. I'm going to record a new album and hopefully a special. And then after those three things are done, I'm going to work on a book. So that's the plan. That's the plan. And will I become the star I want to be? No, but I'm going to continue to do what I did, which is produce original kick-ass content, and hopefully I will have enough of a platform and maybe some interest finally from industry types who can take me to the next level. So that's my plan for 2021. But I would mention Howard Stern, and yeah, part of me wants to see if I can get on Joe Rogan and tell what I really feel to a rival, because yeah, I think I've shared this on this podcast before, but you know, when your impression is too good and too accurate and too honest, and a so-called champion, and I have no confirmation on this, but when suspicions are, and suspicions have been validated, maybe not confirmed but validated, that a so-called fucking hero and tough guy and free, you know, Mr. I don't back down, when you back, only my career could hit a point where I'm a regular on Stern and then they have to back off and hire a fucking hack, a hack of hacks. Because I wasn't scripted enough and I was too well versed and too good off the cuff. I feel like I will never do that show again. Even if I become a comedy fucking superstar and blow up. And because I will, this is that thing Rod says about me, that I manufacture grievances, and that's the Michael Jordan in me, I guess, that always needs that to drive. But I will, the people I remember most in this comedy business or the comedy world are the fans who were with me when I was very low. I will remember Pete and Rod and Karen, the people who gave me a platform and a lifeline. I remember myself and my decision not to sign over any rights to any of my albums, believing that one day it would be lucrative for me to have all the rights to that. That was at a time when I was not making money, when I was doing comedy full time and watching my savings deplete. This isn't me working at the law firm going, oh, I don't get it. It's an investment. No, I needed money and I needed opportunity. And it was very enticing to sort of maybe believe what they were telling me. But I remember the people who were there for me, who appreciated my comedy for its quality and not because I was famous or somebody, quote unquote. But I will also remember the people, whether they did it intentionally or not, but who really, when my career was at forks in roads and didn't help and didn't do right. And when you see somebody chicken shit out, that's a supposed fucking tough guy, free speech warrior, hero guy. But when he gets too fucking soft, old in age, I won't forget that. And maybe I'll never be the comedy star I want to be. And trust me, it will hurt, but it's not like I'm not ready for it. But I will remember the people who just, maybe they weren't out to fuck me over, but I was collateral damage in them being cowards. I will remember that too. And maybe that's not a good thing to remember. Maybe it's not good to, I remember every Brian Russell and every high school coach that cut me, to make the Jordan analogy. And it motivates me. And it's not fake motivation, because this has been a very stressful year. And when I see, you know, I would not begrudge some fucking a Jay Leno or a Jimmy. Well, I begrudge Jimmy Fallon because his fucking show wasted 4 days when I was viral asking me to do a media hold. And then they fucked me over. But then they had the lip sync queen on with no questions asked immediately. So tonight's show, as long as Jimmy Fallon's the host, I always preferred Kimmel and Colbert always. But yeah, you'll never catch me on the Tonight Show, period. I will mark my words. If they are the only late night show calling me, I will pass. The whole point is, if I have the Tonight Show's ear, I can probably get the ear of Kimmel and or Colbert. But I will never do Jimmy Fallon's show. And I probably won't go on Stern again, because I will remember when I need it, when I had earned my opportunity, when I had earned a fucking opportunity, and for whatever cowardice reasons, it was denied, and even worse, lesser talent was elevated along the same lines. You know, anybody who punishes me for being too good at the Trump shit is a fucking coward, and I don't want to associate with their comedy, quote unquote, or their brand or their shit. So that's it. That's a that's my word as a Biden. there it is. We're working on a Joe Biden. Not really, but that just came to mind. But yeah, if this sounds like bitching, so be it. Everybody's become a fucking actor in comedy. You're either some low-life scumbag who wants to say the N-word and is talking free speech, or you're a fucking coward looking to promote and be collab. Let's collab. I think it'd be better if we collaborate. Or I don't want to say anything because they may not like that. Whatever happened to comedians with balls? Not fucking rage issues and hate speech, but just fucking cojones. They circle into their own spheres where they become like a little squad where they go, everybody's a fucking pussy but us. Everybody, like the goth kids on South Park. Where are the Patrice O'Neills? Where are the fucking Greg Giraldos? Okay? And I'm starting to sound like fucking Greg Giraldo. And now it's turning into Sherrod Brown. You were a fucking loser. But those are the comics I like, and I think we all revere them, but nobody's willing to put their money. You know, that's when you could just be a stand-up comedian, and then there was enough of an audience for you to go big. But, you know, Jeselnik is the one guy who seems to have carved out this space, genius, really, where he can get away with saying the offensive things because it's in this cocoon that people accept him in as, oh, he's a cringe comic. Now, he's a really good comedian, and he's acknowledged this, that he has insulated himself from criticism because you don't go to an Anthony Jeselnik show or watch an Anthony Jeselnik performance without knowing, oh, he's the guy who goes there. So he's like protected. It's a brilliant strategy. And I don't think it's a cynical strategy. I think this is the comedy he wants to tell. And it so happens to have insulated him from the woke PC criticisms of that's not comedy, because you're like, oh, that's what he does. You know, so but for the most part, I'm like, I don't know. I just wanted to be the next Greg Giraldo. That's all I wanted out of comedy. And instead, I feel like some fucking angry dude on a street corner on a soapbox, you know, preaching against all the forces of doom closing in on real stand up comedy. So this has been pretty comprehensive and career killing. So thank you for listening. But yeah, it takes a few things. There's a certain threshold I have where I just go, as people have asked of evangelical Christians, what good is it to inherit the whole world and lose your soul? That's how I feel about comedy. If I gotta be a bitch to make it in this art that I love for your freedom to not be a bitch, what's the point? What's the point of being a fucking half-assed comedian? What's the point? That's not the joy of it. That's not the love of comedy. That's being an actor. You know, I'll read someone else's words. I'll go on the talk show circuit and laugh at their jokes and tell a couple stories, and I'll avoid controversy and I won't tweet anything problematic. That's not, I'm not saying every comedian has to be some sort of angry, unfiltered animal. You can be a, like, for instance, I know for a fact Jim Gaffigan, very known as a clean comedian, and I'm not going to say what our private messages were, but a couple of years ago when we were exchanging texts about trying to get him on the Making Podcast Great Again, he recognized me as somebody who wrote unfilteringly about comedy and about things like that. Now, Jim Gaffigan's as clean as they come on stage, and you know, he might have hurt himself with his anti-Trump stuff, but he to him, that was the line. That was the line he drew. And said, well, fuck it. If you don't like me because I want a monster out of the White House, then that's okay. Fuck you, too. But for the most part, he maintained a sort of disciplined approach to comedy, and his comedy was his comedy. I don't think he's any less of a comedian because he chose to be a little more family-friendly and a little more approachable in terms of the content he put out. That's totally okay. But behind the scenes, he was not happy with a lot of PC stuff and a lot of criticism of comedy as an art. And that I can respect. You don't have to have the same style. You don't have to be raw. But you have to, underneath whatever your style of comedy is, a respect for artistic integrity, freedom of speech. You know, I'll respect the clean comic who defends all comedians is just as big a fucking warrior and awesome defender of comedy as the guy who's fucking cursing up a storm and wants to be the next Lenny Bruce. The guys who talk that big shit but back off when confronted, it's understandable, but I don't think you should be revered as fucking big time, big balls defenders of shit. That's my point. But, they, you know, between theft, between lack of originality, between the culture changing, between more and more people critiquing jokes, God, get the fuck out of here. Get the fuck out of here. Let me, like I said, what good is it to inherit the comedy world and lose your comedy soul? That's what I would say, to paraphrase another great comedian, Jesus Christ. That's a whole lot, guys. That's a whole lot. I thought the blueberries and eggs would, but it's, I find myself more and more angry because I believe there's a right way to do comedy. And I'm not talking stylistically or content wise. I'm talking deeper. There's a way to defend comedy, to be about comedy, to be original in comedy. And there's a few ways to be right and a thousand ways to be fucking dead wrong, in my opinion. And once again, I'm not talking content or style. I'm talking deeper. What's your soul of what's the soul behind your comedy? Do you believe, even if you don't like another comedian's stuff, do you believe that they should be out to say that? Do you see why some people like edgier stuff, why some people like cleaner stuff? And it goes both ways. You know, whenever I have people saying, oh, Jerry Seinfeld's a fucking terrible comedian, he's whack. No, he's not. He's not your cup of tea, but he's a brilliant comedian and he's great at what he does. I once bought a Jeff Foxworthy album just because I was like, I felt like he was a skilled comedian. This was early in my career, but I felt like he was skilled at what he did. It may not have been my favorite comedy, although I actually did like a lot of his redneck jokes. You know, it's light humor, but when he said, like, if you do yard work without your shirt on and so does your husband, you might be a redneck, like those made me chuckle. But I could tell he was a gifted storyteller and he knew who he was. But I wonder, I think if you ask Jeff Foxworthy, he might say, oh, I don't like this, that, or the other. But no, that's comedy. They're doing their style of comedy. And just because I don't like jazz music doesn't mean I can't recognize that somebody is a talented musician. That's what I'm saying. But Yeah, it's just, I do find myself very frustrated because, and I think if I could just get out of my fucking apartment and maybe book 20 or 30 gigs, I'll be where I want to be and I can shut this bullshit out and I can say, oh, I don't give a fuck if you're making $1 million as a fucking hack. I'm making my money, doing it my way, and this is my dream. And that would make it, I think, a lot easier to be, to shut out the bullshit and to see the hypocrisy and the cowardice throughout this business and industry, or industry, as I like to say. Wow. I know when I've been talking hard. I've been talking hard because my voice is fucking shot right now. But I still have a couple of things to talk about on a lighter note. So thank you for listening to this. And yes, I plan on, I at this point, I want to be able to showcase what I can do and work with the fans. And I need more fans and I need less shadow banning on Twitter. And by the way, on Tuesday, when you're hearing this, by the time you're listening to this, or maybe not if I put this up Monday night, but on Tuesday, I will be posting a Trump ASPCA video. It's called the ASPCT, the Association, the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Trump. And it is a Sarah McLachlan ASPCA parody ad featuring me as Trump, a comedian, Lori Lehner. I don't even know how to pronounce her last name because we've only met on social media. But she, I commissioned her to do a parody of In the Arms of the Angel, but it's In the Arms of a Traitor. And I think, will this go viral? I don't know. Should it get 10 million hits? Yes. All I have to tell you is Donald Trump drinking Diet Coke out of a saucer. If that doesn't get you interested, I don't know what will. But I hope that video blows up. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But it'll probably make my pilot. It'll probably make the JL Comedy Hour or half hour show pilot. You know, I thought to myself yesterday, I said, I've spent 17 years as a comedian. And for most of those years, I've never doubted my talent. And I hope in 2021, I get to finally just unleash all of it. So I will do a sketch pilot. I will do an album. I will do a special. If I have to self-produce all of them, so be it. Then I will do that. I have self-produced material when I was living paycheck to paycheck. You know, when you're paying $700 in editing, cast, and lighting and audio, when you're not even making $700 a week, you're just dipping into your diminished savings. I can certainly invest in myself now that I made a ton of fucking money in 2020. And if nobody buys it, that's par for the course. But man, I'm going to fucking drop a fucking atomic bomb worth of shit in 2021. To quote Bart Scott, can't wait. New York Jet, famous gif. But now that I've gotten furious, let's talk about just some fun stuff. Two movies. I honestly don't remember if I recommended this movie last week. I think I did on Twitter, but I think I did that on Twitter because I forgot to mention it on the podcast. The 40-year-old Virgin, the 40-year-old Virgin, obviously a play on words, on Netflix. One of my favorite movies I've seen this year. It's obviously been a rough year for movies, but I think it might be the first original I've watched on Netflix this year that I enjoyed. And the thing is, we've been stuck with all these movies, but I thought Da Five Bloods was pretty mediocre. I've seen some action movies that were like mildly entertaining, but mostly mediocre to bad. But this one, oh, I borderline loved this movie. It's about a woman who she's like a struggling playwright. She was kind of a phenom playwright, but then didn't get it produced. And she, oh my God, I joked with somebody on Twitter. I said, if I didn't have a girlfriend, I might be sliding into this woman's DMs just on a feeling like a spiritual artistic connection to this woman's story. I'm not even kidding. Like when I say that, cause I feel like this is somebody, if I ever became famous, I'd at least want to have like a meal with. I'm not even saying romantically, but who knows, folks? There might be that connection. But you failed at art too, despite having tons of talent? Wow. But it's funny. She's like a teacher who is like a hot playwright, but then her whole 30s didn't materialize, and somebody wants her to make like a play that she feels is like a sellout play. And meanwhile, she starts pursuing rap, and she's like pretty good at rap, and she's pursuing that as like an outlet. And I really fucking like this movie. I highly recommend the 40-year-old version. It spoke to me, and I don't talk like that, but God, it was like, it felt so good. And I know I have kind of, as you can probably tell from this episode, I feel, a certain way about art. And she's not a comedian. She's a writer. I think she wrote and directed this shit. It's inspiring and daunting because I'm going, oh wow, she did this. Like she went out and like it's really good and really enjoyable and like good for the, like there's no shortcuts. There's no cheesy shit. But it feels good. It's highly, highly recommend. It gets a JL high recommend. And if you don't like it, man, then I don't know about you. then I want to talk about another movie that I watched that I had higher expectations for and disappointed me greatly. And it's been the source of a limited impersonation in my apartment for the last 2 weeks with a righteous girlfriend laughing spontaneously the first time I did it, which is always a good show because she always tries to not laugh for me. She's my biggest supporter and my most intentional critic. She will laugh at some bullshit on TV and I will tell her some fucking hilarious thing that the world is laughing at and she'll go, and I'll go, that's it. That's all I get. That's all I get from you. Okay. But I bet the 40-year-old version would laugh at my work. You better watch out. The Trial of Chicago 7, written and directed by Aaron Sorkin, starring a shit ton of A-listers and A-minus listers. And all I've been doing walking around the apartment is doing my impersonation of Sacha Baron Cohen doing, I assume, Abbie Hoffman was from Boston. Because he just walks around. One of the first things you hear every time the preview plays on Netflix. We're going to Chicago to protest the Vietnam War. And all I've been doing is walk around the apartment doing that limited Sacha Baron Cohen trying to be a Boston radical or whatever. We're going to Chicago to protest the Vietnam War. This movie, I think Aaron Sorkin is probably unrivaled in modern times as a screenwriter. I mean, the man fucking cranked out The West Wing on coke. Amazing. The West Wing is what like stopped me from writing a script because I was like, well, I want to be the best and I just saw the best and I am a fucking skid mark on the underpants of a rough draft of an Aaron Sorkin script. The West Wing blew me away. And I know it wasn't his first thing. And then I was like, oh, shit, he wrote A Few Good Men, both the play and the movie? Fuck. And he wrote The Social Network, which he won an Oscar for, which is a fucking masterpiece. And what else did he write? Did he have a show before then? He wrote the play of To Kill a Mockingbird, which I fucking hugely enjoyed. So the man has a resume of just fucking A-plus work. He's just a gift. He is a gifted fucking man. But he's written and directed two movies in terms of both doing both. Molly's Game, which I know a lot of people liked, and I think it was a good movie. But Molly's Game, to me, felt way too long. And I thought, oh, that's what happens when a writer who is deservedly confident in his craft and his skills, deservedly believes in himself to the highest degree because he's got fucking just about every probably award you can win for writing. Could have used an editor or director to maybe push back. I thought it was too long. I thought the movie was too long. I thought it was a good movie, but I would have given it like a B+, whereas a lot of people I know were like, it's fucking awesome. And I was like, yeah, I think that's also because it's a hot chick and it's about gambling and celebrities and like, so it's like it's got a lot of like good juicy stuff in it, and it's still got Sorkin's writing. But I just felt like the movie was too long. I felt like he needed a collaboration. Like he needed, just like Social Network. Who knows? That maybe the Social Network would have been a 3-hour movie if Sorkin was directing it. But he had David Fincher, a fellow, platinum level talent
directing it. So now you have two greats collaborating and checking each other, perhaps. So we get to the trial of Chicago 7. We're going to Chicago to protest the Vietnam War. And now, see, this is going to be one of those limited impressions that people watch and see on fucking who people will now see on Netflix and go, oh, that makes me laugh. That's JL's little impression of Sacha Baron Cohen as Abby Hoffman. High expectations for the trial of Chicago 7. Oscar buzz. They did a limited theater release with Netflix, so that kind of tells you that they're really looking for some Oscar. And hey, you've got a lot of talent. First off, if Sacha Baron Cohen gets nominated for an Oscar, it should be for Borat. I think the woman in Borat 2 is going to get a supporting actress nomination. The pickings are a little slimmer this year, but she was great. I think he was great, too. I loved Borat 2. Bruno's still my favorite of his movies, but Borat 2, I thought was really great. And I think he should get nominated for that if he's going to get nominated for something. He'll probably get like a Golden Globe for comedy, obviously, for that. But I don't think anybody's really worthy of anything from Trial of Chicago 7. I was like kind of bored. I didn't like the way it was laid out. I didn't like this kind of reliving the, you know, doing kind of like the, okay, we're going to start with the riot. We're not going to show you the riot. And then we're going to have like, we're going to retell the story throughout the episode, like it's like fucking Memento or something. And so I didn't like the choice he made. It's not a terrible movie, but with about an hour and 45 minutes into it, I was like, yeah, this has been okay. This has been fine. I'm disappointed because I love most of his work. That's the thing. It's not like I go, oh, he's had a couple good. I really like, oh, by the way, Charlie Wilson's War, low key, one of Sorkin's best. Tom Hanks, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Julia Roberts. Go watch that shit. You want another, maybe an on-demand recommendation? Charlie Wilson's War, for anybody who likes political comedy, oh my God. My two favorite political movies of all time are probably Charlie Wilson's War and The Distinguished Gentleman with Eddie Murphy. Super underrated Eddie Murphy movie. The more you know about politics, the funnier it gets. Charlie Wilson's War, incredible movie that I only realized a year or two ago was written. I own it. Never just paid attention to find out that Aaron Sorkin wrote it. So Aaron Sorkin is a master of screenwriting. A master. This ain't it, Trial of Chicago 7. And once again, he directed this. And I was like, man, this isn't to say, yeah, is he a better director than me? Yes. Did he do a competent job directing these movies? Of course. But I feel like this, even more than Molly's Game, required him to collaborate with somebody else. Because I just didn't, I thought it was like a B-minus C-plus movie until the ending, at which point it got the Netflix thumb down on my girlfriend's account so that I can never be shown being negative to the arts community. And you can imagine what else has gotten thumbs down under the protection of her account. but everything's fine. The ending of the movie is so heavy-handed and corny that I looked at my girlfriend while we were watching it, and we both had the same like expression of, oh my God. Because it was like, what would a 15-year-old corny kid who's a fan of Steven Spielberg movies, how would he end this movie? And the ending earned it a thumbs down. It was like, fine. It was going to get no rating from me at the end. And then that ending. And the only thing to come from that movie that I appreciate is me as Sacha Baron Cohen going, we're going to Chicago to protest the Vietnam War. But oof, Charlie Wilson's War, 40-year-old version. There's your recommendations this week. One is on Netflix. One you'd probably have to rent for like $3 on demand. Both highly recommend. I do not recommend the 40-year-old. I do not recommend the Trial of the Chicago 7, even though I am going to Chicago to protest the Vietnam War. So that's the, wow, what an epic episode of just vitriol. But that's, one day they'll discover these podcasts and they'll say, this guy certainly kept it fucking real about comedy. After when once you're going to a club to watch memes lip sync, you'll say, whatever, what was the turning point in comedy? And then they will go back into the archives and go, there was a comedian in 2020, J.L. Covan. He died poor and angry, but he seemed to know what was up. I think he might have identified 2020 as the, much like climate change, 2020 was the make or break year for the future of comedy. He died broke and fat and homeless, but his podcasts live on. And now that he's dead, everybody should buy his albums so that his estate can get rich off of his work while he died broke, not afraid of burning in hell. So my health, my blood test came back. I went to the doctor last week, healthy. I think that's because I've been doing all this healthy eating half the day, like waging war on the second. Like last night I ate half a box of Entenmann's cookies, but for breakfast I had eggs and blueberries and black coffee. And as a snack, I had nuts, cashews, and tea and a glass of water. So my body continues to be just at war with itself. But I think I staved off bad blood results and bad test results and by eating my vitamins and
saying my prayers, brother.
But also, you know, just doing enough healthy eating. But now we're going to put it all together, folks. It's time to eliminate that unhealthy eating, because if I start going on tour in April or May, I want people to see the fit machine ready to dominate, not some fat sad sack of shit on his last legs, okay? So, and the other impressions I was going to do, but I'm not, maybe I'll do, I don't know why I was thinking this, but my old podcast, I deleted like 6 years worth of my podcast. This podcast started in January of 2012, and when I thought I was quitting comedy and looking for regular work, I deleted the entire archives. Now, there were some great, great episodes in there, and I saved a couple on my computer. But for the most part, I was like, you know what? Somebody's going to go through my shit and find like episode 301. You said that Mexicans were making your life miserable. Would you like to revisit that? No, I didn't say that, but that's, you get my point. But now I think I've put in enough content over the last year as I'm headed to Chicago to protest the Vietnam War, because I think there's enough career ending material on the podcast. So that's good. I'm back. Kenny Powers is back. But one of the impressions I used to do, Bates Motel. Whatever his name was, Freddie Highmore and Vera Farmiga, who played young Norman Bates and Norman Bates' mother. I loved the exchanges between them. And, so now I've been walking around my protest the Vietnam War. The one I've been doing a lot is, well, that's what you're saying, mother. Norman, shut up. That was the mom. And then when I would say that, the righteous girlfriend would be like, oh, she talks like, that always got people laughing. So I don't know why I wanted to bring that back. I want to focus more on my Sacha Baron Cohen as Abby Hoffman. But, that Norman Bates, huh? Check out Bates Motel if you need a new show. But who needs a new show? To be honest, I don't even have Peacock. But I have Showtime, HBO, HBO Max, obviously, with HBO. Which, of course, HBO Max has to have exclusives. So I'm like, okay, I guess I'll watch Raised by Wolves at some point because it's not on regular HBO. But I got Showtime, HBO, HBO Max, Hulu, Amazon, and Netflix. Whenever somebody says, oh, you should check out, I'm like, shut the 17 shows behind. Behind what? I don't know. This is what they've done to us. And by the way, yes, on my album Too Big to Fail, 2011's Too Big to Fail, I have a track called Netflix where I discuss the new streaming platform of Netflix and say, what? And yes, that was 9 years ago I was talking about that. Once again, always ahead of his time, not afraid of burning in hell. So, yeah, I don't know why. I just thought about the Norman Bates, and I was like, that made me laugh. Sometimes you do impressions. I don't know what you're talking about, mother. And I never described it until then as a highly emotional Rocky Bullwinkle was my impression of young Norman Bates. So why don't you do that, mother? Why don't you leave the house? Oh, shut up, Norman. No, you shut up. She's my friend, and I want to be friend. Now it really is turning into Rocky Bullwinkle because I haven't fucking watched the show in like 4 years or 3 years, whenever the last season went up. But this has been an episode, folks. This has been a real trip into my fucking brain. But I care. The bottom line is I care about the things I care about in comedy are this. I care about stand-up comedy, the integrity of it, the artistry of it, the pay, the fairness of it. I know those are pie-in-the-sky things, but I really do care. And then I care deeply about my own fucking career. And when either one of those gets fucked over, I get furious. But when both get fucked over, I get enraged. And that's why you got this episode, Not Afraid of Its Career Burning in Hell. So thank you for listening, guys. As always, this was just another trip into my mind. You get some real honest feedback about comedy. And my favorite thing this week was when somebody tweeted at me that J.L. Covan and Sarah Cooper should collaborate. And I finally said something. And it was great shade, but it was done with a velvet glove around the iron fist. And I just wrote, yes, it would be like peanut butter and a picture of jelly. And I felt like, there it is. I have spoken. The time
for honoring yourself will soon be at an end.
Quoting Gladiator. Yeah, but that was it. That's all I had to say. Because, yeah. I don't plan on becoming a success by selling out or being a bitch. Some people can do that. You make the choices you make. It ain't for me. Because like I said, what good is it to inherit the whole world and lose your soul? And that's how I feel about comedy. I'm either going to make it by being real. And I don't mean real. Like, I'm keeping it real. I'm on my own fucking podcast. I can talk freely. But I'm not somebody who's... I'm not going to pick fights. I'm not looking for fights. But I will defend myself. I will defend my art. And I will continue to do it in the way that I believe is the righteous and right way to do comedy. Stylistically, we can all be different. But there are certain things that are not okay and will never be okay in my book. And that's the way I'm going to do comedy, and that's the way I'm going to speak my mind. And if it doesn't happen for me, it doesn't happen for me. But if it does, then I'm going to go to Chicago to protest the Vietnam War. So have a good week, folks. Thank you for listening. Thanks for indulging this show. You get plenty of funny shit from me all week. And God damn it, that Trump ASPCA video is a fucking masterpiece. And then on Thursday, Trump reading Obama's new book. So it's a big fucking week for JL comedy content. And I've told you what the future is. The future is bright. It may not be financially lucrative, but you are going to get a fucking Powerball quantity of great content from me in 2021, whether I have to fucking film it by myself in a fucking dumpster behind an Arby's or if I'm in a big theater with a company behind it. You're getting it. We're all getting it. And that's it. So other than that, let me go check if I have any daytime work, because after episodes like this, I'm reminded you really might need that day job a year or two from now. So thank you for listening, and I'll see you next Tuesday.